Hello, everybody. This is Dane Ginger with the Standing Back Up podcast. Today, I'm here with the author, Jeff Einstein. How you doing this morning, my friend?
I'm well. Thanks very much. Appreciate the invite.
Yes, sir. Mr. Einstein here has got quite the career, man, and credentials under his name. The first computer guides, how-to book series. I think that's huge in its own. What year was that?
1984.
So you were ahead of the game, huh?
Well, that was just about the time when all the big manufacturers were coming out with what everyone thought would be home machines for a robust home market that, of course, didn't materialize until the internet came along, you know, 15 years later or whatever.
Yeah.
So, I was early into it. And then later that same year, I co-founded the nation's first digital advertising agency, which we sold in the mid-90s, just as the dot-com era and the internet was heating up. I was sort of looking for the exits.
Right.
On my way out, starting to have second thoughts about the whole thing.
Have second thoughts? What do you mean?
Having second thoughts about the about my contribution to the rise of digital and to the future, to the prospects of a digital future. I didn't like much what I was seeing shaping up in New York City at the time. The dot-com era was known as the Silicon Alley, was the home of the digital media industry. And I didn't like much what I saw shaping up among people who were involved. I was at that time already in the industry for the better part of a little more than a decade. So I was already considered the old man in the industry amidst all these young Turks, who were all very bright and all graduates of MBA programs from top universities. I of course, never went to college. I describe my four-year high school career as the best 8 days of my life. So the problem that I saw shaping up was that there was a lot of promiscuous money floating around in the late 1990s, and a lot of really young people, really, really bright and really ambitious people, all with the same basic motivations of power and wealth, who had never failed at anything before, and so had no real foothold in reality, which is one of the reasons why the dot-com era ended so quickly and so abruptly when the market crashed in 1999, and it sort of ended that brief era. But anyway, dealing with the young Turks at the time was not an easy thing for me to do because I'd already failed several times before in my life. I was already in my mid-40s by then. And it was a pretty intractable crowd. It's hard to convince somebody that they're wrong when they've never failed.
Right.
All they do is get rich.
Yeah. They say, you know, you have to learn how to lose to be a winner.
That's for sure. That's for sure. And that's never been my problem. unfortunately,
yeah,
never had to worry about that particular aspect of things. But when I saw what was happening in the late 1990s, I started thinking about how digital and how digital scale in the coming century would affect the quality of our lives. And coming into the 21st century, I sort of turned state's witness. I started writing and speaking and just talking about everybody I knew about what I saw as an emerging default, what I call the default addiction to all things media and all things digital. And the question that I came to then behind that was, what happens to our time, our money, and freedom when addiction suddenly becomes the rule rather than the exception?
Right.
And as of the early 21st century, we were all irredeemably addicted to all things media and all things digital. I don't think there's any doubt about that. And so needless to say, my contacts and my career in digital dried up pretty quickly when I went public with my thoughts about digital as a state-sponsored default addiction.
Yeah.
I did a lot of writing about that. I did a lot of exploration about that on the topic of addiction in particular. And digital media addiction beyond that, and started writing about things like the rise of I call it the brave new digital world, modeled after Aldous Huxley's novel of the same name, which envisioned an authoritarian state where people were controlled not by the things they hate or the things they fear, as they were in 1984 in George Orwell's book, but by the things they love and the things they're addicted to. And in Brave New World, it was soma, sex, and entertainment. And now in the American consumer society, it was primarily sex and entertainment as well. Although now we have pretty much a cradle to grave pharmaceutical problem as well.
Yeah, do we ever? Do we ever? That's so.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
My addiction problem was different. I mean, it was a substance, but that's where it started. It's pharmaceuticals, without a doubt. That's where it began.
In more recent years, I've started thinking about an amalgam of the two dystopian visions, Aldous Huxley's and George Orwell's visions. I call it the rise of Huxwell. And Huxwell, the Huxleyan part of it, it's a combination, a totalitarian dystopian state with that combines a compliance mechanism of state-sponsored default addiction from Aldous Huxley's Brave New World with the enforcement mechanisms of 24/7 surveillance, linguistic thought control, state-manufactured hatred via mass formation psychoses, and institutional tyranny, all borrowed from George Orwell's 1984. So it's an amalgam vision. That's what I'm working on now. I'm working on a feature documentary video based on an essay by that, The Rise of Huxley, by the same name, that I published a couple of years ago, that details how we got from there to here in the last 3 to 4 generations, and how we basically, the demise of meaningful ritual over the last 3 or 4 generations, and how that culminated with the rise of Huxwell. Less savory forces sort of filled the void.
So when we talk about the addiction, the meta addiction, we'll just use that word. Me and my wife were talking the other day. My wife works in addiction, substance addiction, and she was saying that how our phones, if we were to leave the house and forget our phone, our whole day would be through off. We wouldn't be able to concentrate or focus on anything else. Now, I used to be that way, right? But we were going out. We went to a comedy show, Killer Beast show, a couple weeks ago, and I left. I didn't have my phone. And we was in the driveway, and I was going to do the directions, and I said, I don't have my phone. And she said, oh, you better go get it. I said, no, I don't want it. I'm fine. And never thought about it again. And she's like, what time sure have changed for you? Because that was it for me. I used to, man, my phone was it, you know, and now it's just a matter of, well, for this and different things, but I'm not married to it anymore. I was, you know?
Yeah. Well, I call the smartphone history's most perfect narcotic.
Yeah. Without a doubt.
Yeah. Certainly the most ubiquitous narcotic. Yeah. And I don't know how your wife feels about this as a professional who deals with addicts, or how you feel about this with your experience. But in my experience, I'm not a big advocate of the addiction as disease model. I think we're very much complicit in our own choices. And I really believe more along the lines of Gabor Mate's addiction as a coping mechanism in response to unresolved childhood trauma and unresolved trauma at large. And I always thought that that mainstream media, that basically the media, mass media, was a device, a compliance device designed at least initially and in part to traumatize us, to keep us traumatized all the time so that we keep coming back to the well for the fix. And there was a prominent social scientist and media and historian named Christopher Lash, who once observed that the real primary function of mass media isn't to deliver propaganda, it's to support the mechanism of addiction in a consumer society.
Everything
else sort of unfolds from there. And I think that's more or less true. And that I also agree with Gabor Mate's assertion that addiction is more or less a normal coping strategy that sometimes goes awry. And that most addicts are at any given point in time, most addicts, the vast majority of addicts, are pretty functional people with mortgages and families and bills to pay and jobs. And sometimes at any given point in time, depending on exigencies and circumstance in our life, we get whacked upside the head and something really goes wrong and we go off the rails. And at those points in time, we may require some sort of outside intervention. But for the most part, addiction is a self-regulating entity. It sort of comes and goes and it ebbs and flows. Sometimes we're less addicted, sometimes we're more addicted, less frequently nowadays, not addicted at all. But most people, most addicts recover or learn to cope with no outside agency involved.
You're correct. Yeah, I used to buy into the fact of it being a disease until I got sober and I said, I'm recovered. And they want me to keep calling myself an addict. And they want us to believe these things because it's a revolving door. Then it's about money. You know, these treatment centers are set up for failure. They just are. Some people may get mad at me for saying that, but that is a fact.
Our healthcare system is set up for failure now.
Without a doubt.
And keep people impoverished and poor and sick.
Yeah. Most addicts are running from something, childhood trauma, as you said a while ago. And it's just things that we haven't dealt with. And once I finally understood that, I finally recovered. You know, I got that. I understood it. And how amazing my life is today because I quit saying those things to myself. I quit telling myself that because I went to probably, we'll say 15 treatment centers, probably somewhere in that area. And I would sit there and I would look at it and I would say, you really don't do a lot in there at all. You know, there's nothing more that you do in there that you can't do either by yourself or on the street with a counselor or therapist or whatever, because in there, it's all about the 12 steps or whatever it is. It's not working on you. And that's what we need to do.
If you really stop and think about how recovery programs function, regardless of the technique and regardless of the profit, not-for-profit status of any given program, What all recovery programs do is they reinsert meaningful ritual into the addict's life. We become addicts when the meaningful rituals in our lives, the family dinner table and the Sabbath day of rest and the things that bring spiritual substance to us first and foremost before they deal with the social, emotional, and physical aspects of our lives. But those things that really are designed to provide spiritual connection, those meaningful rituals that compel us to slow down and contemplate our position or our entirety in the universe, as it were, those are the things that get clobbered by secularization and modern society. And in their absence, we fill the void with what I call mindless rituals of our obsessions and our addictions. And when enough mindless rituals replace enough meaningful rituals, we become addicts.
Right.
And the process of recovery is the reverse engineering of that.
Right.
So in a 12-step program, in Alcoholics Anonymous, for instance, instead of going to a bar with your buddies after work to whack back a few, you make a program call or you go to a meeting. What you're doing is you're basically intervening on a moment-by-moment basis.
Yes.
And reinvigorating and reinitiating these meaningful rituals in your life, which over time, gradually, hopefully, push out the mindless rituals that replace them in the first place.
Yeah, and you're exactly right. And you can take the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and you can read that book and you can work them steps. And what them steps are doing is working on all that stuff that you got going on. That's the miracle part of the program or whatever you want to call it that works is these steps. And they are from God. It was, in my opinion, it was a divine intervention between two men, how it came about. That's my opinion. It's become secularized, this, that, and other. But that's what I was getting at with the treatment centers is that now people, depending on what you're on, you do need some medical detox sometimes. That's a fact.
Yeah, you know, I think on occasion that's definitely required.
And that, to me, that's the importance of a treatment center, that there, and then getting you set up for 12 steps or whatever it is that's going to work on you. And unfortunately, we don't see that in a lot of them. That's what I was saying about them. They're not all that way, but a lot of them don't give you the time, and that's insurance, and that's whatever it is. And you kind of walk out of there going, what do I do now? You know, and that's why they all say, hey, very first thing you do, go to a meeting. Because as you said, that what it is, it gets you back on track in life and gives you a meaning back in life.
Yeah, I think that the most significant contribution of Alcoholics Anonymous, apart from bringing people together in the same room, the physical plant of it, apart from that, is its emphasis on the spiritual. Again, I'm not a fan of the addiction as a disease model. I think it stigmatizes people and it turns them into victims.
Yes. I agree.
But I think what it did do successfully, less so now, but less so with everything nowadays, is that it emphasized the spiritual component, where no fewer than 7 or 8 of the 12 steps are God or higher power based.
Yes.
And require you to give something up to a higher power or to recognize the primacy of a higher power. And I think that's, I talk to people when I talk around, I give talks around the area every now and then, and I talk about our four basic needs, and I list them in order as spiritual, social, emotional, and physical. And if you look at the old Maslow's hierarchy of needs, it's a straight linear thing that, depending on what chart you're looking at, either goes up or to the side, left to right. And you start with the physical and you satisfy the physical, and then you satisfy the emotional, and then you satisfy, the social or whatever. And you finally become transcendent and self-aware, and you acquire spirituality as a result of going through these other steps. I always thought that was backwards. It's a very Western approach to things. I always thought that it's the other way around, that it begins with the spiritual. Everything begins, that we're at essence spiritual beings, in a much bigger spiritual world than the one that we can define for ourselves.
I agree 1,000,000%. It all I say it begins with God. I'm a spiritual guy. I'm not really big on religion, but I'm a spiritual guy. And
yeah, that there's a sequence to the DNA to fulfilling our basic needs, in the same sense that there's a sequence to our genomes, to our genetic material stuff in our DNA. It follows a very precise sequence that defines who we are and helps them define who we are. And I think that it begins with the spiritual, and then it goes, and then if we're intact spiritually, then chances are we can deal with social trauma and with our families and with our friends. We'll be on a better footing to do that. And if we have stronger relationships with our families and friends, we'll be better equipped emotionally, because all of our emotional cues come in the mirrors that we situate around ourselves and other people and things. And if we're emotionally balanced, we'll be physically healthier.
Yes.
So there's a definitive sequence to the satisfaction of our four basic needs. And if you start by disconnecting yourself from the spiritual, then basically it's like a sequence of toxic tributaries that all empty into this really, really horrible reservoir at the end of the flow, and which is our healthcare system now. It's like a repository for all of our garbage, on all of our crap behavior.
Yeah.
So that's, I really believe that if we take care of ourselves spiritually up front, then it will go a long way towards helping us satisfy our other three basic needs. But first, the other three basic needs are more fungible. They, as exigencies and circumstances come and go, sometimes we fall down, we hurt ourselves, we got to deal with the physical. Sometimes we have a death in the family, suddenly we have to deal with the social and the emotional
yes.
aspects of things. But the solid spiritual footing is the primary characteristic of health, I think.
Yeah, I agree 100%. I've said it a long time. You know, I lived a life, man. I lived a very bad life. My addiction started at age 15. It really started earlier than that, but my opioid addiction. I had an accident as a kid, and I kept having these surgeries. And they gave me a narcotic pain medicine at my last surgery. And I took it, and, man, I thought I really found something. And,
yeah, you did.
You know, and... it's my mother was an alcoholic and addict as well. The guy who got her pregnant with me was alcoholic also. So it was all over me. If you want to believe it, comes in genes and this, that, and the other. And I did believe that for a long time until I started recovering. And I was like, I'm not gonna call it a disease, man. I'm gonna call it a habit. And because it's like anything else, I can get sober just like I can get addicted. And that's what I did. And it took a long time. 21 years in prison, and finally I understood God. I had to begin with God, and that's what I put first, and that's when I truly started to recover. Anything up to that point was, and I was just spinning my wheels in the mud. And I say that no matter what program you're going to do or what you're trying to work on yourself, you got to get spiritual, man. You got to get with the spirit. You got to get your spirit right.
Yeah, I think that's a good, that's the best starting point, regardless of what you want to do in life or where you want to go and what you want to be at the end of the day. I have a blog on Substack called The Quality of Life Resistance Movement. And it's really the response, the antidote to the rise of Huxwell. Quality of Life Resistance Movement.
Okay.
It's on Substack. And it's when I first started thinking along the lines of the rise of Huxwell, and because the rise of Huxwell came from something else. It came from a really linear progression in my own life. In the early 21st century, I saw the confluence of state-sponsored default addiction come together with what I called runaway digital scale. Mm-hmm. Suddenly everything in our life was institutionalized.
Right.
And all the institutions that were way too big to fail in the 20th century were suddenly 10 times larger and more powerful. And all the day-to-day functions of our lives were being by institutional relationships. So if you look on your smartphone now, every app on your smartphone, in essence, is an institutional relationship that didn't exist
right.
10 or 15 years ago. And that displaces time and money and other resources and attention that you would be paying to more personal relationships in your life. And that's the idea. That's the whole, you know, company. People tend to think that too big to fail and things like state-sponsored default addiction, that these are the unintended consequences of bad plans or a failure to plan. And I always tell people that, you know, there's nothing of the sort. These things are the plan.
Right.
These things didn't happen by accident. You know, Google didn't get as big as it is by accident, or Apple or Microsoft or Amazon. None of these things happened by accident.
Right.
You know, COVID didn't happen by, as it turned out, probably didn't happen by accident.
No.
At least not our response to it.
No.
It was pretty calculated, the whole thing. So, you know, it's... So in response to those, the confluence of those two factors, state-sponsored default addiction and runaway digital scale, the institutional tyranny of runaway digital scale, I came up with the rise of Huxwell, which is what that thing is, and the quality of life resistance movement, which poses, I think, a realistic alternative to it. Mm-hmm. And there are three calls to action offered by quality of life resistance movement. The first is basically to turn away from distraction and turn your time and attention to the things and people in your life that contribute to the quality of your life, to the quality of your spiritual, social, emotional, and physical well-being. The second call to action is to reinstitute meaningful ritual in your life on a gradual basis, because that's the only way it really works, for the most part. Unless you've been in a really extreme place like you were, or other addicts have been, or other people who have encountered real dire circumstances in their lives and suddenly, for whatever reason, see the light.
Yeah.
Are able to change and have the wherewithal to change their lives around. For most people, those things happen pretty gradually.
Yeah.
And so I always recommend to people to seek out moderation first.
Yeah.
You always seek out moderation, and look for the middle road. And so the second call to action is to reinstitute meaningful ritual in your lives. And meaningful ritual is defined as any ritual, anything you do on a regular basis that contributes to one or more of those four basic needs: spiritual, social, emotional, and physical. And the third call to action is a return to local autonomy, which is the only way really to deal with this, the tyranny of centralized digital scale, centralized power, which is what we see in institutions in this country right now. Institutionally is pretty much a one-party town. It's a very dangerous place. That's why I call it totalitarian, because every institution thinks the same way now. They're all involved with the same thought process. There's diversity of everything except thought.
Right.
In institutional America. Doesn't matter whether it's a government institution or agency or a private corporation or an NGO. They all think the same way now, and it's all about power and money right now.
Power and money.
Yeah, it's all about a one-party town right now.
Yeah.
So very dangerous time. I tell people that I think Huxwell is going to be with us for at least another generation if we're lucky enough to escape it.
Yeah, if we're lucky enough to escape it. That's the thing, you know, and trying to get people to institute these things in their lives is a big thing, especially our children. You know, when I grew up, we didn't have all that stuff. And then our kids now, man, these video games or just whatever it is, nobody does anything that we used to do, whether it's eating dinner. And even if you do, someone's on their phone or got to have the television on or something of sorts. That's why I like the idea I've been seeing where people have been saying, hey, we're going on a trip and we're leaving all that stuff behind. And you see people, I mean, literally almost losing their mind of the thought that they're not going to have their video game or their whatever. And I look around at the industrialized world and I'm going, who's going to fix stuff? Who's going to work on stuff? And then
this cannot be a top-down solution. At the top is where all the rot is.
Right.
It's incredibly corrupt.
Yeah.
And so this has to be a grassroots movement.
Yes.
That's why I say local autonomy, meaningful ritual. Meaningful ritual is a very personal thing, one-on-one thing. Local autonomy is a small-scale, next-door neighbor kind of issue, you know, bread-and-butter issue. And turning away from distraction basically means turning away from that top-down, centralized expertise, as they call it. So, you know, I always think that the experts are like the high priests. Monopoly.
Yeah, it's money. You know, you said that, and there's nothing wrong with being successful and having it, but when it becomes love and power, and that's all we see now. I don't understand how a lot of things happen and how we let it happen and we continue to let it happen. I don't want to talk politics really, but I'll just bring it up. You know, when you have a politician who is in there for 4 to 6 years and they're making, let's say, $175,000 a year, and then they leave and they're worth $200 million.
Yeah.
I mean, come on, man. You know,
what's
going on? Why isn't anyone saying something about this? Why isn't it? Because everybody's in it together. And we know that.
I have a theory I call it conspiracy by fiat.
Yeah.
It's what happens and how it's replaced basic, you know, the old physical backroom, smoke-filled room conspiracy where a bunch of people will get together and conspire.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no need to do that anymore. And the reason why is because the actual physical conspiracies have been replaced by conspiracy by fiat. And it's what happens when generations of Ivy League students, of the best and the brightest, basically, who only go to the Ivy League in order to become powerful and wealthy in the first place, all graduate from the same professors teaching the same course studies, and they all graduate with the same identical ambitions of power and wealth. And then they embark on their careers, and it's a pretty small club, a pretty small and incestuous club. At that, even when they graduate, it's all based on, everything they do is based on their alumni associations. Right. So that you have a situation where a Harvard law graduate gets a job at a K Street lobbying firm in Washington, D.C., and sits across a table one day from a Yale political science graduate who is now working as an intern for a congressperson, and they sit down to negotiate a piece of legislation. And then 5 years later, the same two people meet across the same table, only now they've switched sides. Now the political scientist is working for the K Street lobbyist because he knows the ins and outs of Congress. And now the lobbyist is working for the congressman because he knows how to deal with the lobbyists.
Right.
And if they keep doing that over a course of 20 or 30 years, and they swap enough influence and enough money in the exchange across the table, eventually they wind up with a seat at an academic chair at a big university. So that at the end of the day, the scoundrels in Wall Street and the scoundrels in Washington, D.C., and the scoundrels in academia are all the same scoundrels at different stages of their careers.
Yeah. And they've got control.
Conspiracy by fiat. They don't have to sit down and talk conspiracy because they all think the same way and towards the same ends to begin with.
And it just keeps the same ones in the power.
Exactly.
I understand that. I've never looked at it that way. I love that you said that. That opened my eyes to something there. Because I've always said, I've read enough books on different things. I didn't have an education. I was like you. I had a seventh grade education, basically, when I went to prison. But I was intelligent. I just never applied myself. And so I learned to read, and I would read about different things. And sometimes I didn't know if I was reading propaganda or what I was reading, but I read enough to understand that there's a small group of people who's running it all. And it's been that way. And it's going to continue being that way until something happens and something fails.
The real bias, social bias of digital technology is the accelerated consolidation of power and wealth. Mm-hmm. And that basically all media has been that way forever. From the great metropolitan daily newspapers in the early 20th century, they were the bully pulpit guys way back then. And then the radio guys came along, then the TV, then the cable TV, and then finally the internet. The difference between the print guys and the electronic media guys is that the print, as a mass medium, print promotes linear thought and reason. And when it first came to pass as a result of the Gutenberg press, the first thing that came off the Gutenberg press was a whole bunch of Bibles that people took into their homes, and suddenly they didn't have to go to the church and deal with the guy with the black robes anymore in order to get the word of God. And what that meant was the end of Western theocracy. That killed the Western theocracies. And it gave rise to nation states and the Enlightenment and the American and French and industrial revolutions and the scientific method. And all these things became as a result of the Age of Reason. It came as a result of the printing press, basically, and print as a mass medium.
Right.
And the primary social bias of print was democracy. As the great metropolitan dailies started to flex their muscles and the great publishing houses came into being in the early 20th century, all of a sudden democracy started showing up around the world. And democracy started spreading. But at about the same time, that was when electronic media, the early 20th century electronic media, in the form of music and radio primarily, and motion pictures and radio, gave rise to big personalities and had the exact opposite attributes as print. Instead of reason and linear thought, it promoted tribalism and emotionalism and it promoted larger-than-life personalities like Mussolini and Woodrow Wilson and FDR and Hitler and Stalin and Mao. All these huge personalities got these big boosts from these giant electronic megaphones, and the primary social bias was fascism. It was a consolidation of state and corporate power.
Yeah.
And that's what we see in steroids right now with the digital. The natural tendency is towards the accumulation of power and wealth at digital scale, and we are not at all equipped to deal with the accumulation of power and wealth at digital scale.
Right.
And we're still trying to come to grips with the first round of social media.
Right.
And it's wrecking kids. It's destroying young people.
That's all they do. I found myself doing it at a point. And then now I don't. I use it for trying to grow my podcast and things like that. I don't stay on it all the time. I'm not a fan of it because what I found out very fast was how much bull crap there is on there. And what I also found is, it's amazing. You can, let's just use TikTok. We'll just say TikTok. Okay. You can make a video with some real true meaning about it, something very insightful, and it won't get 200 views, but you can make a video about some made up nonsense of some kind of fear somewhere or something, and it goes to the moon.
And it's well, you know, the primary product of all commercial media, especially electronic media, regardless of what you're actually selling or what product or service you're actually, the primary product of mass media is our fear and envy.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the two things that they sell, because those are the two things that sell. You know, every next time you see a commercial on TV or whatever, or something on the radio, ask yourself, are they trying to scare me or are they trying to make me envious?
Right.
And those two are a combination of those two, always.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah. So there's no secret why everyone is scared to death nowadays, and why we're giving away our civil liberties in exchange for this phantom safety and security. The whole idea of you know, the Patriot Act and COVID, our response to COVID. COVID was more the response to COVID was more about getting rid of Donald Trump than it was getting rid of COVID.
Without a doubt.
No question about it. This was all about getting rid of, you know, creating, you know, this mass formations. I always thought that there were three. I think there are three mass formation psychoses in the 21st century so far. The first was 9-1-1, our response to 9-1-1. And that's when they passed the Patriot Act. And I fell prey to that one. And that's when they passed the Patriot Act. And took away half of our civil liberties in exchange for some presumed security against some terrorists halfway around the world. And then the next one, of course, was Trump derangement syndrome, when everybody woke up in 2016 and discovered that Trump had beat Hillary Clinton and
nuts.
And then the third one was COVID, and the COVID I always saw just as an extension of Trump derangement syndrome.
Yeah, I agree. Now I sit here and I do wonder, you know, again, politics is whatever, but I sit here and I think to myself, and I don't vote because I can't vote. So, and I never really paid a lot of attention to politics until the past few years. And I look at things and I'm going, okay, so this year we have Joe Biden, who most people say he's doing a horrible job. Some say he's whatever. And then you have Trump, but they have no one else. Joe Biden's going to be it. And so I'm sitting here going, what's coming next, man? What's going to come before this election? Because something's going to come. Something.
Yeah. May very well be some crisis that makes us all mail in our votes again.
Yeah.
And whatever it is, you can be pretty much rest assured that it will mean more votes in the mail.
I agree. They want all the people that come across the border to vote Democrat. That's what I see. I said that from day one.
I think that's part of it. I also think that there's, you know, that things of this magnitude don't happen to countries this powerful. Things like our southern border, just being so wide open without our explicit, you know, no knowledge and approval.
Yes.
At least on an official level, that there's no way that the Mexican cartels could be in control of our southern border if the FBI and the CIA and somebody in this country is making tens of billions of dollars a year.
Yes. From
human trafficking and drugs. And there's got to be some sort of quid pro quo going on with this deep state agencies and the cartels all around the world.
Yeah, it always has been. It always has been. Like his name escapes me, but there was one that he was real big in the drug thing. I don't know why I can't remember his name now. Then all of a sudden he became a problem. And he became a problem because he got too big and they weren't able to control him anymore. I've always felt that our government has made money off of it. And you'll never steer me in another direction because I know there's no way that you can tell me that you can go out here and catch somebody who stole a truck, something that small, but you can't catch someone who's bringing 100 tons of cocaine across the border. There's no way.
Especially when you know exactly where he lives and exactly what he's doing every second of the day.
When we have control and power, and then all of a sudden you can go in there and get them. You could have went and got them the whole time.
Yeah.
There's more to it. And people, they misdirect you in this country. That's a big thing that they do.
Well, all the entire woke agenda is a misdirection. It's class warfare.
Yeah.
Plain and simple against, poor and middle class people of all colors worldwide right now. You know, the green agenda, the climate warming, anti-racism, gender equity, all these things, every item of the class of the woke agenda is another example of class warfare that's being used and conducted as a diversion to basically get your mind. As long as you can call somebody a racist and get somebody to think that everything's about racism, then they're not seeing that, hey, you know what? They're talking about the same old plantation mentality that existed in the Deep South 150 years ago.
Yeah.
And all they did was move it to the inner cities.
That's it.
It's the same guys, the same players, the same party, everything about it is the same. And it's the same old tune, same old song. I'm not a big political guy.
Me neither.
No love lost for either political party in this country. But right now, because I see what's happening in terms of the skew of power, institutional power, and how it's all on one side right now, I think that the Democratic Party is the most dangerous political institution in the world right now. And it's a lick since the 1820s. It's all about controlling and owning people of color.
Yeah, without a doubt. And I don't see how people of color can't see that. Even in the voting and the bills that have passed, it's all you have to do. And people don't do that. They would rather get on their phone and look at nonsense than figure out what's really going on. I've got some storms coming in, man. Default meta addiction. That's a real thing. And people need to understand that and realize where we're headed and where we're going. Whether it's, we always, with our children, would only let them play like an hour on their video games. We won't let them play for days on end, and that's all they do. Because what has happened is, nobody has a personal relationship anymore. Nobody, even on the street, nobody looks at each other. And whenever someone takes the time just to look at someone for a minute and say, how you doing today? It can completely change that person's day, and we don't do it because we're so caught up in our phone.
Absolutely. Just a simple smile can change somebody's entire day around.
Yes, it does.
That's such a simple thing to do.
Yeah.
It's an easy, no-cost solution to things.
Yeah. I remember we were talking about that. I was like, somebody was walking down the road, and I was just standing on the porch, and they just said, hey, how you doing? And, man, that just changed my whole mood that day. And that's all we got. And that's all we got to do, and we just don't do it. And
sure.
Get out of the fear and get back into people.
I agree. I think that that's what the Quality of Life Resistance Movement website's all about. I have a complete tool set. These are tools that I put together in the late 1990s and early 21st century. that haven't changed at all. There are no moving parts here. They're really simple, and anybody can use them. Families can use them. Communities can use them. Individuals can use them. They're completely scalable in either way, up or down. And basically they do, what they do is they make the visible, help make the invisible visible for people.
How do we find all this stuff, man?
Go to Quality of Life Resistance Movement on Substack, and you'll find it all.
I know you wrote a bunch of books. Are they on there too? How can we find your books?
The books are out of print. You can still find one of my books is still on Amazon. It's called The Media Addict's Handbook.
Media Addict's Handbook.
Yeah, Restoring the Quality of Life in the Great Age of Mediation.
That was published back in
2012.
All right, my friends. Honor to meet you, man.
Likewise. Thank you very much. You have a very interesting story. And you're doing God's work, so keep it up.
Man, thank you so much for saying that. That's what we like to hear. I look forward to seeing you again.
I look forward to that myself. You have a good one.
All right. You too. God bless. Thanks, my friend.